is no shortage of expert advice out there about what we should be eating to keep our bodies well-nourished without taking in more than we need. Since the 80s, even folks who don't have diabetes are advised to mostly steer clear of foods that cause a big spike in blood glucose levels. But as our ability to measure the effects of different foods on different bodies has improved, scientists have made a major discovery. The glycemic load of specific foods can vary from one person to the next, so that some people's blood sugar went up more after eating a bowl of rice than a bowl of ice cream. One woman in a study learned her blood sugar hit the roof every time she ate tomatoes. After decades of a one-size-fits-all approach to a healthy diet, scientists are beginning to think they can do better. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The story of those discoveries of how our particular genetics, lifestyles, and microbiomes affect how our bodies will respond to different foods is one chapter of Daniel M. Davis's fascinating new book, which also covers advancements in microscopy, brain imaging, and gene therapies. Davis is professor of immunology at the University of Manchester, and the book is called The Secret Body: How the New Science of the Human Body is Changing the Way We Live. Dan, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Hi, it's wonderful to be here, Chris.
Wonderful to have you. And before we get started, we want to welcome new listeners tuning in today to WNYE in New York City. We are very happy to have you with us. Okay, Dan, you say we are learning that the human body is, I love this, a world full of other worlds. What do you mean by that?
Well, essentially, there's so many new technologies that we have developed in the last few years to dig really deep into what is happening inside the human body. And what we find is that there's so many aspects to it that we couldn't have even imagined just a few decades ago. Essentially, you know, every organ is full of an elaborate menagerie of cells. Every cell has a cityscape within it of scaffold capsules, monorails, things moving around, full of proteins, enzymes, sugars, fats, and other chemicals. Really, your body is simply a world full of other worlds.
Something I didn't really understand until I picked up this book is that it's harder than non-scientists might imagine to differentiate between different types of cells. Why is that so hard?
Oh, that's a wonderful frontier that we've hit upon through the use of new technology. So very obviously, a nerve cell is different from an immune cell, for example. A red blood cell is different from a cell in your kidney. So clearly, there are different cells in the body that have different jobs. But let's look at that in a little bit more detail. All the cells in your body, there's 37 trillion of them. All the cells in your body have exactly the same set of genes, the sort of code inside you that makes you who you are, the DNA, all of your genes. There's about 20,000 genes that make up the human genome, and all of those genes are in all of your cells. So what makes one cell different from another cell, say a red blood cell different from a kidney cell or an immune cell? What makes those cells different is which genes they're using. So all of the genes that you have are present in all of your cells, but only some of the genes are then turned on to make proteins, to do stuff in those cells. So a red blood cell will have a set of the genes being turned on to do stuff to make it have the job of a red blood cell. Now, the big frontier is that we can start to look at the cells in terms of which of all the 20,000 genes they're using. And we can start then plotting on graphs where they are. So if you imagine if you only had two genes and then we wanted to look at which of those two genes are switched on or off, you could use whether one is switched on or off as its sort of coordinate. So you could move along one direction, the x-axis and the y-axis, and put a dot where the cell is according to how much of the gene one and gene two it's using. You could do that for 20,000 genes. And that means you get bunches of cells with similar traits. But what's really amazing is that it's a very, very broad scale. So when you start looking at an immune cell, there's now almost any number of different categories of immune cells, really rigorously, carefully defined by which of all the 20,000 genes they're using. So it now becomes not so black and white that there's just an immune cell. There's any number of different types of immune cell, for example. And so we get to this place where the cells of the human body are on an enormous variable scale in what they all do.
And this is the process called flow cytometry.
Right. So in the book, I describe the sort of origins of this type of work, which comes from a technology called flow cytometry. And I tell the sort of wonderful story of a husband and wife team, Len and Lee Herzenberg, who were married when Len was 21 and Lee was 18, and they set off from New York to travel 3,000 miles to, for love and science to work in Caltech. And they invent a machine to start to analyze in detail what's happening in each of the individual cells of the body. But that was, back in the sort of 50s and 60s and 70s. And now that type of work has led to this frontier where we are now, when instead of just looking at a few attributes of cells, we're looking at how much cells use of all these 20,000 genes that are available in every single cell. And so that gives us a whole nother level of being able to scrutinize what every cell is. If you just take a sample of someone's blood, instead of just saying there are a few types of cells, a red blood cell, a white blood cell, and some other cells, instead of saying that, we can look at really in detail what every single, which of the genes every single cell is using. And that gives us an enormous spectrum and variability in what the cells of the body are. In fact, it's even quite hard to define exactly the different types of cells when you get down to this level of detail.
I did not expect jellyfish to be an important part of this story.
Right, so that's true. So the story really begins with Japanese scientist Osamu Shimomura. And in the 1960s, he was visiting the San Juan Islands, which are about 90 miles north of Seattle, and collecting jellyfish. And as you say, that does not sound like that would be the right path to a Nobel Prize and changing the law of how microscopes might work. But that was where this all began. And he, of course, was not directly interested in microscopes or anything sort of where this work ended up in helping medicines and things. He was just interested in how animals and sea creatures use color to communicate with each other. So he was picking a particular jellyfish out of the water where the cells at the rim of the sort of umbrella shape of the jellyfish, the cells at the rim would glow green. And he was interested in working out exactly what made those jellyfish cells glow green. And so him and his family were going out to someone else, picking up loads of jellyfish. And then they were sort of isolating the cells and doing various purification processes to try and identify the actual jellyfish molecule that glowed green. And he was doing that with his family. I mean, there are these wonderful photos of him and little kids, picking out these jellyfish. People would used to come up to him on the pier and say, what do you, how do you cook these jellyfish? And they would say, I have to explain, oh no, we're not going to eat them. We're gonna do some scientific experiments with them. And so eventually he isolated these two particular molecules, these protein molecules in jellyfish that make it have this green glow. And one of them, which has now very widely known as the green fluorescent protein, the GFP is its short name, has become used in biology in all sorts of ways. Because what happens is once he isolated the protein molecule of the jellyfish that glows green, then other scientist Doug Prasher isolated the gene in the jellyfish that makes that green glowing protein. And then still another scientist, Martin Chalfie, in New York, put that gene into other organisms. So you could make a green glowing bacteria or worms. So the jellyfish gene could be taken out from the jellyfish and used in another organism to make the green glowing molecule. And then eventually the idea was that you would make that green glowing gene, you could put it next to another gene, and so you would make a sort of combination of proteins. You'd have a protein that you were in, say, the human cell that you wanted to see where it was, and it would be stuck to the green glowing protein from the jellyfish, so now you could see it. So it kind of would work like a laser pointer inside the cell, so you could see exactly where some molecule is that you wanted to know where it was. And it was actually Martin Chalfie's wife, Tula Haynes-Loughrigg, who did that in her lab first. Eventually that work spurred on the people to make microscopes, because with that green glowing protein, you had a way to watch the positioning of individual protein molecules inside cells, and that then led to people then needing to make microscopes even better to be able to use that technology. So you go from jellyfish in the 1960s right through to building new microscopes that eventually win the Nobel Prize in 2014, and then hundreds, if not thousands, of labs around the world are using these new kind of microscopes, including my own, to try and to use these technologies to see what happens inside human cells better than ever before.
So, how have those kinds of high-resolution images helped lead to new ideas for treating disease?
Well, I mean, I don't want to give an example from my own lab in this just to sort of amplify my own research, but it's at least easy for me to do that because I know the research in my own lab very well. So I'll just give you an example from my own lab, but of course there are hundreds of labs using these kinds of microscopes. So one of the things that we do in my own research lab is look at how an immune cell sticks and sees a cancer cell and then is able to kill that cancer cell. And it turns out that by just watching that process happen at a sort of minuscule level, looking right detail of what the molecules are doing, what you can see when that happens is an immune cell will stick on to a cancer cell, and there'll be sort of receptors protruding out from the immune cell that latch on to molecules of the cancer cell to know that it's a cancer cell. And then that triggers a process whereby the immune cell has within inside it sort of these packets that contain toxic molecules. And those packets of toxic molecules will then move from within inside the immune cell up to the contact with the cancer cell. And then they would sort of fuse, connect with the outside surface of the immune cell and deliver those toxic molecules into the cancer cell, and then the cancer cell would die. Now, by watching that process in detail, you can see that as the toxic molecules are moving up to the to, towards the cancer cell to kill it, there's a sort of meshwork of proteins that has to sort of open up to allow those toxic molecules to be released through them. One of the things then that we discovered was that a particular drug used for multiple myeloma patients called lenalidomide opens up that meshwork more to make it easier for the immune cell to deliver those toxic molecules. So in that case, we saw by watching the minuscule details of how the process worked, we learned a bit about how one of the drugs against cancer works, and now that allows us to think about using that same drug in another situation. And in fact, that other situation came up when I was at a conference, and you start talking to people in the bar, and one of the other scientists there from the NIH in the USA was looking at children with a very rare genetic disease. And he showed that in these children that suffered recurrent infections, and sadly they often died quite young, they had an inability for their immune cells to release these toxic molecules to kill, for example, a virus-infected cell or some other cell that needed to be killed in the body. And so it turned out that we thought maybe you could use the drug that was once used for cancer patients to look at what if that drug would help immune cells from these children be able to kill disease cells better. Now, we couldn't really use the drug in children because it wasn't, I mean, I do very basic science and don't do clinical work as such, but we could take blood from these children and isolate the immune cells. At least in a lab dish, we could show that the cancer medicine did slightly help the immune cells from these children able to kill disease cells better. So that it doesn't, it's not a sort of medical advance because we don't know if there could be other side effects and whatnot of using this type of drug, but at least it sort of helped us show that there is part of of how that disease manifests. We could see that opening up that meshwork to allow toxic molecules to come out of immune cells better, that might be helpful.
All right, switching gears here. The world was astonished in 1978 when Louise Brown was the first IVF baby ever born. How has the technology changed since that time?
Well, there's been an enormous number of changes in the use of IVF. I mean, I suppose at the very least, as many listeners will be aware, you can screen embryos for some genetic variation. So what happens is, as the sperm and egg are used to create an embryo in vitro, once it's got to a certain number of cells, you can isolate a cell out of the embryo, analyze it for its any particular genetic variations, and then select, say, that embryo rather than another embryo as the one you would then directly use. So that is is an enormous advance that has come from detailed understanding of how embryos work and also, of course, all we know about genetics. There is, of course, also the idea that you could even genetically modify embryos, and there's been that well-known story where it's been claimed, and I think most scientists seem to think that it was probably true, that they genetically modified a human embryo in China. So essentially there's genetic manipulation or screening of embryos is an enormous area of science where, it raises an enormous number of issues for how we live and what we think of genetic inheritance, essentially.
So there is the possibility now of finding out whether you carry a genetic mutation that is associated with a really terrible disease. Some people might want to know that as soon as possible. Some people might never want to know.
Yes, exactly. So that's exactly the kind of thing where I think this revolution is different, where you have to really decide for yourself. Do you want, how much of your own personal genetic inheritance do you want to know about? Do you want to take, nutritional advice from an algorithm, which is how you open the hour that we have? Do you want to know, an analysis of your stool for what's happening in your own personal microbiome? So I think these are personal decisions that you have to make. And I think that it's also extremely difficult to make these decisions when there's so much uncertainty. So, for example, there's several examples I give in the book. One of them is a story that someone I spoke to about, where they find out that they have a certain likelihood of a particular issue with a sort of relatively rare connective tissue disorder. And then it's sort of how to act on that information is actually really, really hard. So they were given advice like, you need to be a bit careful. Don't do things where you might get a sudden jolt. And then the person who had that information from their genes was then like, well, but what does that actually mean in my life? What does that mean? Am I allowed to still play basketball, for example, where there's obviously some element of being jolted about, but it's not that bad. What does it mean? And the science is very fuzzy and it's very hard to act on this. So although there are some very clear situations, Angelina Jolie is obviously a very famous and very important example, where her genetic inheritance was very, very strongly suggesting that, guiding her actions. But in a lot of genetic information. It's a lot more fuzzy than that. And it's very, very hard to act on the information. And yet you've got to make decisions. Do you want to know? Do you not want to know? How would you act on the information?
Which is not to say that we shouldn't be pursuing this knowledge, even for its own sake, or knowing that down the line we might draw conclusions about things. Talk about what we've learned about these like tiny packets of genetic materials that individual cells can send out as a means of communication.
Right. So I coming back to the one an earlier topic that we spoke about was how good microscopes can be, and the fact that you can now create microscopes to see inside the body, or see what cells are doing better than ever before. And one of the things that I mean, many labs have observed now is that cells can exchange genetic material with each other, and they can send out very small packets of one of these packets is called exosomes, and they include genetic material and proteins and other biological things, and essentially they moving through the blood, impacting what different organs and tissues are doing in a way that we really, really hardly understand at all. So it's a sort of glimpse of yet another, we spoke right at the beginning of the body being a world, world full of other worlds. And there's other worlds still yet to really properly understand, like these very, very, very small packets of things being sent out by cells to travel through the blood. Even in, for example, breast milk, it's been shown that these very, very small packets containing all sorts of complicated biological things are present, and it's very, very hard to understand what they all do. So, we're really at the edge. That's right at the edge of our understanding what these packets of different things do. I suppose that the low-hanging fruit in being able to use that right now would be in diagnosis, that we might be able to use scrutinize the contents of these small packets to perhaps indicate some type of disease that hasn't quite yet given us problems, but is on its way, and perhaps a more a preemptive medical intervention could be used in some of these situations. But it's still very, very, very much on the cutting edge of what we know about how the human body works.
Many of us are already a little perplexed by all the advice about what we're supposed to eat. And I want to go back to this thing that I introduced the hour with because it really just blows my mind how much we're beginning to understand about the variation from one human body to the next in how we respond to different foods.
Yes, that was quite an amazing discoveries that were made about how foods affect different people. So what happened was that people were analyzing the blood sugar levels in individuals when they ate different kinds of foods, as well as when they were eating very prescribed foods. And although on the average, it was what you would expect. So on that average, if people ate some sugary food like an ice cream, then on average it tended to mean that sugar levels would spike in that situation. It was an in, there's an enormous variability. So much so that you get these very, very striking results where one person would not really spike their sugar levels when they ate ice cream, but they would spike their sugar levels when they ate, say, sushi, which you wouldn't have thought. So the people who did this work, two Israeli scientists, Elinav and Segal, they are advocating that, one of the big reasons why diets may tend not to really work well is that really having a good diet is a very, very personal thing. And so that means we need this sort of data cloud of information about a person, which certainly would involve an analysis of their microbiome in their intestine, as a way of trying to get at what would make a good diet for you as an individual. That's the fundamental science that there's a personal level to what makes a good diet, and you might be able to get at that if you had all this information about you, like your genes and your microbiome. Then that throws up a whole new set of questions for society, of course, because if it was true that it would be healthy to know what's a personal good diet for you, there's certainly the question of, well, do you want to know that? And secondly, who should pay for that? Is it, if it's going to be of health benefit, then should it be your insurance company that helps pay for that, because down the line that's going to keep you healthier? Should it be, or in the UK we have a, the National Health Service, should they be paying for this kind of information, because knowing what your personal good diet is would be a health benefit? So there's a lot of issues that come and are going to come more and more down the line with this kind of deep dive into your own personal data.
There are also interesting questions here about the way that would affect the sort of blunt instruments that we currently use in place of these really targeted things, right? So we look at BMI now, which can sort of give us an idea about across broad populations about health, but honestly, it's used to stigmatize people a lot.
Yes, I think that's an extremely important issue, that as we dig deeper and deeper into how the body works, then that inevitably leads to an analysis of the spectrum that exists within the human population. And that in turn then leads to sort of categories of, this is within a normal range and this is now outside the normal range. And so we've seen that with the body mass index. And although you might be able to use the body mass index to good effect, understanding that it might be better, it might be informative to know where you are and how you might want to nudge your lifestyle or diet towards a different body mass index, there are enormous problems with that, because there's a lot of psychological baggage that comes with being in the wrong place within that number range. And we society has sort of come to this place where thinness is seen as being, highly superior almost, and that's just with that one number. And we're on the cusp of being able to define a lot more numbers about each of us and our bodies. And so we've got to be, I think, very, very careful about using this kind of information. And any, all of us are going to be subnormal if enough things are measured. And so the question is, how you've got to get the right context for thinking about this information and thinking deeply about how much of this information you want to know for yourself. Right now you can get a watch that tells you a few things about yourself, but I would think it's not far-fetched at all that sometime in the near future, you would be able to buy a watch that tells a lot about you, and you've got to get that into context and think about how much you want to know about yourself.
We need to think about how much we want to know about ourselves and then how much we're willing to do about it. You could spend a lot of mental energy every day on things that may or may not ultimately have that big of a payoff in the end, but now that we can measure them, we know about them, and suddenly there's something we're worrying about.
Yes, so I completely agree with that, and this is essentially really why I was driven to write a book about this. That we have all these technologies, we're moving towards wonderful, fundamental new levels of understanding about what it really means to be human, and now we need to really take stock and think carefully about how we're going to use this information. And again, if you come back to the body mass index example, it certainly is a useful number, but it's also causing us problems. And I think it's going to be true for all the metrics that we will have soon and coming down the line. Even when you get a genetic analysis that you could do now that tells you have a 20% increase of getting some likelihood of getting some particular illness. How are you going to act on that information? And it's not easy to relate to these changes in numbers and what it means, and how you're going to live your life. The stories that we have for who we are and how we live come very much from the science around us. It used to be that we imagined illness as being an imbalance of the four humors. And it's impossible now for us to relate to that as an idea, that you would feel ill and think, oh, there's some imbalance between some liquid in my body. But now, of course, you relate to different aspects of yourself and think about it in terms of the health and it, and to some extent, it really defines the story you tell yourself about who you are. And I think we've got to be very careful and analyze deeply about what we want people to, how people are going to live with that kind of information.
Daniel M. Davis is professor of immunology at the University of Manchester. His new book is called The Secret Body: How the New Science of the Human Body is Changing the Way We Live. Dan, thanks very much for making time to talk with us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. It was absolutely wonderful to talk to you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. If you'd like to subscribe to our podcast, it is free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERAThink and it'll be delivered right to you. You can also get that podcast on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.